Welcome to Backpacker Radio, episode number 5. I am Zach Bader. I'm just going for a neutral name because I'm not happy with the one
I'm
that
Zach
I bestowed upon myself. I am Zach Badger Davis, joined to my right by my co-host.
Hello, I'm Juliana Chauncey.
And we're going to get into a very fun conversation about not necessarily long distance backpacking, but some mountaineering stuff. That's coming up in a second. First, I want to just make an exciting announcement that this episode is brought to you by the Cinnamon Connection.
That's us.
I'm just kidding. It's not brought to you by the Cinnamon Connection. We are the Cinnamon Connection. You can't bring a podcast to you from yourself. It just doesn't work out. But this podcast could be brought to you by you. That's because we just started a Patreon page. I believe that's how it's pronounced. Which allows you guys to support us. You can make a very nominal donation. I think it's by the month. I'm still figuring this platform out.
It's either by the month or by the post, depending on how you set it.
Gotcha. It's by the month right now. Maybe if I do it by the episode, you guys would be more incentivized to give us your hard-earned money. Or maybe not. I don't know. Maybe people don't really want to hear more of us, and they would donate to not hear us. So maybe we could
an
anti-donation.
The
shut up fund.
The shut us up, yeah.
So let us know which is more likely to give us your money, because
we should make that a reward level.
Yeah.
If you pledge this much, you could shut us up.
Phew. I might even donate to that.
Yeah.
I already don't want to hear my voice anymore this episode.
Oh, me neither.
Yeah. Okay. We're all in agreement that Badger just needs to stop talking.
Yeah, go.
But unfortunately, that's not how podcasts work, so we're going to keep rolling. A couple other announcements. So a new series that I just brainstormed while on the rowing machine today at the gym, I'm glad it came to me, was that I want to, we want to introduce a new series to the podcast where we are featuring current thru hikers' stories. So if you're hiking the trail this year, 2018, reach out to us at podcast@thetrek.co. And basically, we just want to track your adventure from start to finish. We want to know the ups, the downs, what your life is like. We want to hear it all. So if this is something that would be of interest to you, to hear your story featured on this podcast on a, I think, semi-weekly basis, we have to talk about the frequency, but it's shaping up to be roughly every other week. But if you want to hear your voice as opposed to my voice on this podcast, reach out to us at podcast@thetrek.co and we will get you more information. Chauncey, you have anything you want to add to that?
Nope.
Cool. All right. Let's get right into it. So today, I'm very stoked that we are joined by our new buddy from Nepal. She flew out from Nepal just to hang out with us tonight.
Yeah, we're that cool.
Yeah. We are joined by Shaylee Basnett. Did I say that correctly?
Pretty close.
Correct me. Where did I mess
up? I pronounce it Shaylee Basnett.
Well, the way you pronounce it is the way that it is pronounced. So, Shaylee, thank you so much for joining us. So yeah, let's just start from the beginning. What's your story? And I'm going to start off with the home run note from your bio, which is that you summited Mount Everest. And not only you summited Everest, but you didn't really have much of a mountaineering background beforehand. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm, that's true.
Okay.
So I was born in Kathmandu, raised in Kathmandu in a middle-class family. So got to go to school. That was all cool. But when I was growing up, sports and being active, especially, I don't know, maybe just my school, it was not a cool thing for girls to do. So I literally didn't play any sport all the years I was growing up. So my secret dream was to just go out and play, like use my body. I was just very, very thrilled to know that I have a human body. And I used to get really excited about it as a kid. And I would be like, one day I'm going to grow up and I'm just going to use this body and run and jump and swim and dance and whatever it is. So that's how my sort of secret desire towards doing something like mountaineering sort of came up. But yeah, I didn't do anything until 24. And this was the time I'd finished college. I'd started working, making a little bit of money.
What were you doing, out of curiosity?
I was working as a journalist at this point of time. Yeah, and I, through my one of my assignments, I came to know about a female expedition that was like being formed at the time. Uh-huh. So I asked them, like, how do you decide on if somebody can become a member? And the leaders told me that would be sent for 45 days of like intense mountaineering training program designed for professional mountaineers by Nepal Mountaineering Association. And then we'd have a number of months before we go to Everest. So there was a good training program before we even thought about Everest. So I was like, well, I got nothing to lose. Let me go see how this training comes out. If I suck at it, then there's journalism. No one can force me to climb Everest. But if it works out, then I might give it a thought. So I in my head, I originally signed up just for the training. And I think that training was more difficult than climbing Everest, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, did a lot of people make like quit during the training? Did everyone make it through? Or
so, no, people don't quit in this training. They didn't. The reason is, I think at this point of time, it's been over 40 years, this training has been like organized in Nepal every year. And like I said, it's Nepal Mountaineering Association. It's a very serious, it's a certification program. And this is a program where mountaineers who've been working as crew for years and years, they apply. So obviously you aren't expected to fail because there's a very small number of women, very limited participation of women in this sector. They have a certain, I think, to encourage more women, they'll accept even if women don't have a lot of experience. So basically when I got in there, I was there, we were five Nepali women. All of us were part of the same team trying to go to Everest, and we had a one British woman. So at this point, like, imagine we're 33 trainees and five of us are practically like with very limited or zero mountaineering experience versus all the men there who've been working in this field for many, many, many years. So it was, it's kind of funny, but you don't quit.
Yeah. Right. So what kind of things did they teach you?
It starts from the most basic stuff. So you go for really not too like risky or outrageous rock climbing, theoretical classes about the dangers in the mountain, hydration, you know, very basic stuff, how to put on your crampons properly. They'll teach you everything. Because the thing is, even for the people who've been there working in the mountains for many, many years, it's not necessary that they might be doing it right. So that's why it's important to start from basic stuff. And this is called basic mountaineering training for a reason. So you start from all of these, like the kind of clouds to, you know, the most basic you can think of. And then you keep advancing to the right technique to hold your ice axe, maybe. And then river crossing. Then we go up to the glacier where we're literally like, would be falling down crevasses and would have to rescue ourselves, rescue our teammates, ice climbing, all sorts of. So from very basic all the way to make you confident enough to function in the mountain and take care of your friends and teammates and save life, yours or others if needed to. So that is all packed into 45 days of training that starts from Kathmandu, which is 1,300 meters, I think, in meters. So 1,300 meters and goes all the way up to around 17,000-18,000 feet.
Wow. Okay.
And when you finish that, is that the group that you're going to summit with when you went and summited Everest, or did you split up?
So here's what happened. Our team came together in the year 2007. So till 2007, Nepal had only seven female who had made it to Everest. And it's a very small number, obviously. So there was an organization called Climbers Club and led by two Sherpa men.
You said in Nepal. There
in
was
Nepal.
Always, okay.
So. Yeah, this is Nepal. So for Nepal, we had few Nepali mountaineers who were female. And so there was this organization, Climbers Club, led by two Sherpa men, Dagombu Sherpa and Pema Dodi Sherpa. So they came up with the idea of organizing all Nepali women's expedition to Everest. And the idea was to encourage more women into the sector. So we all came to know about it from friends, family, media, different sources, and eventually we became a team of 10 women. So out of this 10 women, hardly two had mountaineering experiences, and eight of us were fresh. So, and out of the eight, some had some kind of training. So they could continue that training in Kathmandu. Whereas the five of us who sort of formed in time to enroll for this regular training, we went for that high mountain training. And the five of us learned the skills, sort of got to know about our own abilities, and we returned to Kathmandu and joined the rest of the team. And we worked for several other months where we were training a lot, but we were also raising funds, making some noise in the media, all sorts of like teamwork. And eventually we went for Everest later in 2008.
Now, what's the most nerve-wracking day in this process? Because you go from, you know, you said you don't have any athletic background, and then you commit to this 45-day-long training. Mm-hmm. But you said it starts off slowly. Mm-hmm. But obviously, you're building up to the ultimate goal of summiting the highest mountain in the world that kills people. So it was day one of the training the most nerve-wracking point? Is it the day that you're actually out on the mountain? I mean, I know it's multiple days. At what point did your nerves hit their peak, so to speak?
So for me, there were a couple very memorable moments. The first was when we went rock climbing in Kathmandu, and I was up the easiest face, like the easiest face, and I could not climb all of it. Like I was like only halfway through, and my body just like locked. Like I wouldn't be able to go up. Now, as a student, as a journalist, I always had good things going for myself. So. I kind of had never failed. And here I was 23 when I was training, 23, and I couldn't do it, and I was embarrassed. Like, you know, it was this very biting you, your ego. So I didn't want to rappel down at all, and my instructors like really convinced me, you know, eventually that I had to come down because it was lunchtime, not because I couldn't do it.
Right.
It was lunchtime. So I said, okay, yeah. So I said, okay, fine. And then when I was rappelling down, I was thinking, oh my God, this is going to be the most embarrassing moment of my life. And we're a women team. So there are four other women who are going to, you know, be on Everest with me. We're supposed to go climb Everest. And here I am. I couldn't even climb the easiest rock face. And I'm thinking, wow. I mean, and all the conditioning we have, you know, women against women, that women are women's worst enemies, and jealousy, bitchy, and this and that. And I'm thinking, these women, like, they're gonna tear me apart. And the minute my feet touches the ground, all of them, they were like, you know, like, avoid the right ledge, put the rope in the center, like, don't stuck your butt out. They were so supportive. They were so supportive. It was the hardest day, but at the same time, it was the most motivating moment, like, of my life.
Sure.
And that was the moment when I decided, I don't care. If these girls want to go to the moon, I'll go.
Yeah.
So that was my very first. And then there were more to come throughout the training. But I was with a fantastic team of women, and we were able to laugh off everything. I made a lot of jokes on myself. So that kind of saved me. Humor kind of saved me. So there was not a moment after that. There were a lot of times when I was still slow and struggling, but I was able to laugh everything off, and I just enjoyed the process.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about the hike? Like, okay, so now it's come time, you're going to start Everest. Like, how was that? What happened?
So for the actual climb up on Everest, you take this flight from Kathmandu to an airfield called Lukla, which was built by Sir Edmund Hillary. So it's about 25 minutes flight. You get off here and trek for about 8 to 10 days, depending on how many rest days you want to take. So about, let's say, 10 days to base camp of Everest. You arrive at the base camp, and you rest there for a couple of days. By rest, you basically mean staying active in high altitude.
Yeah, acclimate, yeah.
Yeah,
that's so, what I was looking for, acclimatized.
Yeah. So basically, you don't gain a lot of altitude. When you first reach base camp, the idea is not to go higher immediately. You just, like, play around, stay active, but don't go higher that much. And then we go up to the forest camp, spend two nights there, came back to base camp. Then again, couple days break, and go to the second camp, there two nights, come back again to the base camp, rest for a couple of days. If your team has time and let's say, the luxury of going up again, then you spend again some time at the third camp, which is, I think, at this point about 23,000 feet.
And why do they go back to base camp afterwards? Why don't they?
This
just
is
stay
the
there?
Acclimatization process. Okay. Because it just is so high. Like, imagine base camp is like 17,000 feet.
Right.
So the camp's higher from that. Like, you could be the toughest person on the planet, but human bodies are just not designed to work at its best.
Right.
Even at 17,000. And this is your base camp, so that bulk of the mountain is still above you. So you don't want to just rush it up. You want to give it that time. And over time, it's like having superpower when the RBCs in your blood count increases.
Yeah.
And you can see that you can function better. So you need that extra superpower, I would say, to take the final summit push. So that's why you do all of that up and down. And then finally, before the summit push, you take a longer break, maybe a week, 10 days, depending on, you know, weather and a lot of different things. You pick a target date and then you head for the summit. You obviously stop at the second camp, third camp, and fourth camp, make it to the summit, come back to the fourth camp, and then spend a night there. Then you spend a night at the second camp, then come back to the base camp. So it's 4 days going up, 3 days coming down.
And what was it like waking up that morning and knowing, like, I'm summiting today?
So my story is a bit weird. Because we're a team of 10 women led by 2 Sherpa men, and we had obviously a bigger crew for a lot of different other responsibilities. We're split into 2 teams, and I was part of the first team. So when I was leaving from the last camp, on my way up, there was I had a Sherpa assisting me, guiding me, and then his summit suit, like, torn apart around his knee. So we had to turn around because at this point, the rest of my team was already ahead of me. So, and we were on a shoestring budget, so we didn't have radio or anything to communicate with the rest of the team. So we turn around, and that was the coldest night of my life, both physically and emotionally, because once you sort of pushed for the summit, and if you don't make it, you kind of know that you may not get a second chance, because A, you'll be exhausted, and then B, resources are limited. So the resources might be required by the rest of your team. I mean, you might have run out of everything by this point of time. So the logical thing is to go down. So knowing that there might not be a second chance, but then you can't risk somebody's safety for your summit goals. So coming down, that was a very emotional, dark night.
Yeah.
So that evening was completely different. And when I started, I didn't have a good feeling that evening. So I think it was some kind of a good thing, a blessing in disguise, that I didn't have to go super high that day. But obviously, I was not happy about it. And then the rest of my teammates who went up, they made it. And then the leader, he told me over radio next morning that if it was not my fault and if I'm still in good shape, he'll think about giving me a second chance with the second team. And from that moment, I was like, I'm already on the summit. That was the moment when, in my head, I was already on the summit. So when I actually stepped out the next time with my second team, it was like, how do you say it in English? It's like that it's already happened. Now you just have to tick it off.
So this was just, you just had a supernatural confidence that everything was going to click this time.
Yeah. I was absolutely sure that this time I told myself, when my leader told me that he would consider giving me a second chance, that was one, and this was sometime around morning. And then I spent that entire day in the South Col, the highest camp, just by myself, because I'm waiting for the first team to come down. Mm-hmm. And then the second team is just about to start from the base camp, so I'm there by myself in this tent, and I'm dozing off that entire day. I doze off, I get up, I eat something, I drink something, I just look outside, appreciate the beauty. I have nothing to do that day.
Yeah.
And literally I was telling myself, I was thinking, people lose weight in climbs. Here I am in the highest camp in the world. All I'm doing is eating and sleeping. I'm going to put on some weight here.
Did you?
Which is a good thing for me, because I've always been a petite person, and I had to gain, I think, more than 15 pounds for Everest.
Uh-huh.
So, gaining weight is a good thing for me.
Yeah.
So,
what was your diet to put on 15 pounds?
I don't think I did anything special. I cut down on lemon I used to eat a lot of lemon, like a plateful.
Interesting.
Every single day.
I was going to say, I think we just hit on the number one diet secret.
Lemon is known for its fat cutting properties.
We need to buy stock in lemon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because obviously we can buy stock before the episode goes out.
Right.
Get rich quick scheme. Anyways. Yeah. Okay, so you cut back on lemon and nothing else? You didn't?
So in Nepal, our staple diet is a big plate of rice with lentil soup and curry. Hmm. We increased our meat consumption at that time and also added a lot of fruit. So it wasn't anything that out of the box. We did not follow any program or anything, because we didn't have the luxury to do that. Just the same thing, but there was a lot more exercise, and also your appetite increases. And because I thought that core exercises sort of makes you slimmer, so I also cut down on my core exercises, which now, going with what I know today, is not the smartest move.
Yeah.
But that's definitely something. So I had... For sort of first time in my life, I had a little sort of, what do you call it, a belly, like a beer belly, just a tiny pout.
Yeah.
And I was so proud. I was so proud.
Yeah.
And then later I learned how difficult it's to get rid of that once you have it.
Much easier to acquire it than it is to get rid of it, I can attest.
So then, okay, so you got a second chance and you got to go up.
So going up the second time... It was, like I was saying before, I knew this was going to totally happen, because when that day I was just eating and sleeping in the highest camp. At one point, I completely dozed off, and I'm sort of coming back to my senses, and I hear in a distant FM station, somebody's playing FM station in their tent, and there's a female voice in Nepali language announcing 3 p.m. news, and she went something like, the five members of the first Inclusive Women Everest Expedition have made it on top of Everest, and the five members' names, da 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 da, and I was like, I was transported literally to the summit of Everest. And so this was literally the moment when I was like, I just need to step out of this tent, and that's going to be the summit of Everest. Hmm. So it was magical. I just knew that was going to happen. So that evening, my friends came down from the summit. Five girls had made it. And the reason I think also I was so excited was because when we were going up, there was a lot of apprehension. People did not believe a big women team, young girls, not much experience. Everything was against us. So there was a lot of criticism, skepticism, all those things you can think of. So a lot of discouragement. And even for us, we didn't know how many of us would make it to the summit. Because when you're a mountaineering team, your goal is at least one person on the summit. But even more importantly, everybody comes back alive and safe. So our goal was not that everybody has to be on the summit. So it was a big mystery for us of knowing who's going to make it or not. And then to know that six of us went up and I came back, but it was not because I was not in condition to do it. I came back for other logistic reason. And then the five friends who made it. So that five was a big number. Mm-hmm. That was not something we expected. That's why when I heard that news, I was just like, okay, I'm there already. So next afternoon, my second team arrived, and then when we started from the camp, it was a beautiful, beautiful night. The stars look amazingly much bigger.
What time do you leave camp?
So we start around 10:30, between 10 to 11 in the evening.
Okay, so it's PM, it's in the nighttime.
So most mountains, big mountains, when you're climbing, the summit push is usually sometime early in the morning or in the night. The idea is to keep going up throughout the night. You make it to the summit sometime in the morning and you have the daylight to come back down. So that's what we did.
Do you have to drink coffee or tea to get up for it? Or there's so much adrenaline that you're stoked to be going?
Buzzing, aren't you? Yeah.
There is a lot of adrenaline and then pressure, stress, everything. Because literally from the fourth camp, it's your make it or break it moment. And it's not as simple as just make it or break it. It's also, it could mean success and failure, or it could also be life and death.
Yeah.
There are literally dead bodies that you see when you're going up for the summit. So knowing that could be you, the stakes are really, really high. So, and in any case, once you go to high altitude, you lose your sleep, you lose appetite in any case. So here, it's just trying to relax, trying to sort of calm your nerves down, but the stakes are so high that sleeping is is when you, what you do after you make it to the summit. Then you're like completely... Yeah, just like a rock.
Gotcha.
And did it ever faze you that, you know, you're walking past people that have died and, you know, they just have to leave the body at that point? But did it ever faze you that, you know, people don't make it back down and you're going up?
Not really. So I think, like I was saying, I joined mountaineering because I was not good at, you know, anything physical. I had no experience. And that's why I trained so hard for this. And that's the core of climbing big mountain and any kind of adventure. You train so hard. And training is not just the physical part. It's also there's a big component for mental preparedness, mental training. And I think at that time, I was so in that flow, in that zone that, yeah, nothing could have scared me. So on Everest, I was, you know, dead bodies and exposures, whatever I came through, like my own failure, the first time I tried to go up, nothing sort of made me ever doubt that if this was a good decision or if I'm gonna make it or not. After climbing Everest, when I came back to Kathmandu, I was scared to be on a bus. That's a different story.
And what was it like standing on the top of the summit?
On the summit, it's, I think, very emotional, spiritual, more than the physical, you know, part of it. You make it, and to know that this is the highest point on the planet, like you cannot stand on Earth and be higher than this. It just is mind blowing. It is.
I got mind blown when I walked in this room because I was like, she's been on the tallest spot in the planet. And I'm sitting
in the
next
presence
to
her. Of greatness.
I was sitting there and I was like, this is so cool.
Well, yeah, but the summit is, so it was a clear morning when I was on the summit, so you can see.
What time do you summit?
Around 8 in the morning.
Okay, so this is about 10 hours after you left the fourth camp?
This is, is about 10 hours going up, about 45 minutes in the summit, on the summit, and then I think we left around 9 from the summit, and I reached to the fourth camp around 3:30.
Okay. And so all five girls made it in the second group?
Funny story. This time, 5 of us left and 4 made it. And then one had to turn around for similar, like, silly reasons, not her fault. And then she got to go another day because there was a Nepali man going up. So it worked out and she
Your
could
exact
join.
Same situation.
Yeah, exact same situation. And then she made it. So on 3 different days, we summited. I was on the summit with my friends. One is Asha from the flatlands of Nepal. So we tease her that she's from Africa of Nepal. So she's the first person, male or female, to be on the summit of Everest from this part of the country. So it's really cool. And then I had my friend Pema Diki Sherpa. And my friend Usha Bista was also there with me. And then I was there. So 4 of us were on the summit of Everest together. And Pema Diki, she was very emotional. She was just looking at her parents' picture and, like, her tears rolling down her eyes. Usha was in a big accident the year before, so it was also very emotional for her. So the two of them were, I think, not very interactive, whereas Asa and me, we sang and danced on the summit of Everest.
No tears?
No tears.
Uh-huh.
We were laughing, we're smiling, and you look around, the entire world looks like a big ocean of just clouds, thick clouds, and mountains popping up like everywhere. And you feel like, wow, I'm on the highest point on the planet, and all I can see is the mountains. Like, shouldn't I be able to see the beaches? So, and it's just a lot of shades of blue and white. And in our culture, we regard mountains as gods. So there was even this belief that you should not actually climb mountains because they're gods and they might get upset. So, I mean, you know, cultures started thousands and thousands of years ago. Mountaineering is only maybe 100 years old, especially on Everest. 1953 was when Everest was climbed the first time. So to think about, wow, people knowing that mountains are so beautiful and significant so many years ago, like thousands and thousands of years, I had more respect, I think, for culture, because when I was on the summit, I felt like, okay, if there's a force called nature or God who needs a place to dwell, like, this would be it. Mm. It is just so pristine and powerful, like, this is it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why when people say you feel closer to God when you're on the mountains, and I completely agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's common in thru-hiking that after people complete a thru-hike, there's like a stint of depression after they complete their journey. Did you go through a low after summiting? Or I just got to imagine that that's got
to
be, you know,
hard to
one of the highlights of your life, if not the highlight. Just following that, that's got to be a tough act.
I think one is you become so close with your team that you just want to be with them and left alone. So that was one. That was not the fun. Like, the minute we arrived at the airport, our families sort of, you know, took us away from each other, and we didn't want to be away from each other. So that was like, damn, I wanted more time with my girls, you know. Yeah. That is one. And very honestly speaking, when I look back, our real struggle started after Everest. Because for Everest, I think we're just new, fresh. We didn't know what to expect. There was a lot of maybe discouragement, but we're not rattled or affected by it at all. After Everest, we're all over media, and everybody's talking about us, and, you know, we're everywhere. We're big news. So we decided to climb the seven summits next. And we thought, you know, this should be easy now. And it was not. Huh. Oh, my God. It was... way crazier.
So just for the people that don't know, what are the seven summits?
So seven summits is the highest mountain in each continent. So you got seven continents in the world. There's a little debate about, you know, whether the mountain in Australia highest to be considered is Mount Kosciuszko or Carson's Pyramid. But that's a different story. But the highest mountain in each continent. So we decided to do this. And as you know, learning by doing kind of thing, we realized that we were still operating in the same social structure, in the same economy of the nation. So there was no sponsorships, very difficult to deal with the organizing part of everything. And here we committed to something that's not one mountain. It's one mountain in one country, and then you have to move to the next. So that was way more difficult. And I was the coordinator of the team, so we're leading ourselves. We don't have other people sort of leading us, guiding us through this, and we don't have footsteps to follow, because there are very few teams who have done it. There were no female teams that had done it. So there was no footsteps to follow. So I don't think we got even the time to process Everest. We jumped into another mission, and that ate every bit of our existence, energy, everything you can call it.
Yeah.
So which mountain came next?
2010, we were in Australia, Kosciuszko. It's a very small mountain, and some don't consider it part of the seven summits, but we went for it, and the climbing wasn't the difficult part at all. It was for a team of women from Nepal to go to a different country. And then we also visited seven schools. We had some media interaction. We visited a number of cities. So putting all of that together and being able to pull that off, that was the more challenging part. And we did that well. And then after that, we immediately in August, September, the same year, 2010, we went to Russia to climb the highest in Europe, Mount Elbrus. And again, there, Russia language is a big issue, because our mountaineering climbs were so close, we were not able to get enough sponsorship for both. So we ended up taking big amount of loan for the second one, because we're like, well, everybody loves us, you know, they'll write us checks when we come back. So we learned that nobody likes to support something that's already happened. It sounds like common sense, but it came the hard way.
Yeah, but weren't you breaking ground in that you were the first all women's team to do the seven summits?
When we looked up, there was no female team who had done it. When we go to climb these mountains, there are obviously male guides or other, you know, assistants who are supporting us in the climbs and other parts of the journey as well. But we're a team that stuck together from Everest right till the last mountain, and we did it together as a team. So that way, would be the first female team in the world to do it.
That's awesome. So you said that you were coordinating the seven summits.
Uh-huh.
How many of these summits did you actually mount yourself?
Okay, so Everest, and then Kosciuszko, Elbrus in Europe, Russia, then we had a gap of 2.5 years because we didn't have funds. So this is when I hit depression, like not clinical depression, but hit my rock bottom.
Adventure withdrawal. And,
because we didn't have the funds to sponsor the next climb. Two members quit the journey. There were things being said about us, questions again, and you have no answers to anything. You just know in your heart of hearts that you're committed, but you have no idea, absolutely no clue how this is going to happen. So for 2.5 years, we're really struggling, and the seven of us were still in the team where one day we said, what do we do? This is too big. Should we give up? What do we do now? And I think at that time what we decided was more like, it's the same in the mountains. You don't know what's going to come next. You just have faith and put one foot in front of the other. And we said, let's keep trying. Maybe something will happen. Something will come up. So literally after 2.5 years, we're in Africa, Kilimanjaro. So these are the mountains I've climbed. And then next year in 2014, we went to Argentina for the highest South American mountain, Mount Aconcagua. Here I had to turn around. So I had a frost nip and I was around 6,500 meters. So this is, you can see the summit literally from this point, but I had a frost nip and it was already starting to get more chillier. So I decided it would be safer to come back down. And two of my friends were also having similar issues, like we're together. So three of us turned around, four of my friends made it. And then for Alaska and Antarctica, four members of my team made it. So either we didn't have enough logistic support or enough funds, so we cut down on the number of people. So for the last two climbing, I was not part of the climbing team. And then on the fifth one, I had to turn around, and then I made it on the four.
Were there people on your team that actually did all seven? I know like as a unit, someone made it on each mountain, but there were people that did all seven.
So three of my friends have made it to all seven.
Yeah.
One, she has made it to six. So she's yet to climb Antarctica. In Antarctica, Vincent
what
Massif.
What is the tallest mountain in Antarctica?
There's this massif. It's and the highest point is called Vincent Massif. Uh-huh. So there's so again, it's not a technically difficult mountain to climb. Yeah. Obviously, Antarctica, it's the weather.
Right.
There can be really, really challenging. So that's a bigger challenge. And then just the logistics of getting there is more challenging.
Yeah. Antarctica just feels like a different planet to me. Right. Just like stepping foot on it seems out of this world.
Even the logistics of like, I mean, from start to finish doing these seven summits, it's nearly 10 years?
For us, so we came together in 2007, but obviously not knowing at this point of time that we're going to take up the Seven Summits Challenge. We came together in 2007 just to climb Everest in 2008. And then in 2009, we decided to do the Seven Summits. And 10, we did the first one. And then end of 2014, early 2015 is when we finished. So from we've been working very tightly together from 7 to early 15.
Wow. So 8 years is a long time to commit to being able to do something like this.
Yeah.
So you said it was a combination of sponsorships and taking out loans. Where were the sponsorships coming out of? Were you doing like the what is it, GoFundMe or?
No, we didn't. We tried something on the crowdfunding thing. It didn't work. I mean, there's a whole different science to it and strategies. So our funding did not come from the Western world much at all. Our funding mostly came from the government of Nepal, Nepal Mountaineering Association, Nepal Tourism Board. There is an association of trekking agencies in Nepal called TAN. They were one of our supporters. One of our biggest supporters for Everest was the United Nations World Food Program. They also supported us big for Kilimanjaro in Africa. And a lot of organizations similar. So the interesting thing is our support did not come in a major way from the private sector. Mm. And I think that's also because of the kind of economy we are. Our support came more from the government, from the development sector, from the nonprofit sector. Those were the ones who chipped in. Mm-hmm. And still, we did have to sort of sponsor ourselves for maybe half of all the expenses as well.
And are you still tight with your team?
Yeah. So after 2015, when we finished, the idea was to celebrate and just, you know, having a closing ceremony and decide what we want to do next as a team and also individually. Everybody definitely needed a break. So we're supposed to do that, but we had a big earthquake in Nepal in April. So that meeting never happened. So we've never had a closing, you know, party or anything of the seven summits. So immediately after that, my friend Maya, she's from this district called Sindhupalchok, which was one of the worst hit in the earthquake. So we started providing relief and support material to her village. And then we saw that, well, earthquake was a problem, but there were bigger problems before that in this part, like lack of quality education and problem of trafficking young girls. So we decided to invest in schools here, like help rebuild the schools here. So we're currently working with about six schools, rebuilding them, like infrastructure and all of that, quality education. We also train a group of young women who are survivors of trafficking. So we've been training them for 3 years now. Started with basic training in Kathmandu, hiking and basic outdoor stuff, to language and all of that. And two of them got their certification as trekking guides last summer, and they've started working. So we still, Maya and I, are co-leading this survivor training program and school rebuilding program. So we're representing, but as a team, we haven't been able to do any outdoor activity as such, but we are still, very...
Still giving back.
Yeah, still going good.
And if people wanted to look up the program, is there a name for it? Is there somewhere they can find it online if they were to want to look into it?
If you Google Seven Summits Women, I always sort of boast about this. Don't forget Seven Summits. And obviously, we're women. That's what makes us kind of different. So Seven Summits Women, spell the seven out, S-E-V-E-N, S-U-M-M-I-T-S, Seven Summits Women. Our website is sevensummitswomen.org. And if you look us on Facebook, there's just a page called Seven Summits Women. So you can follow our journey through our website or Facebook.
Awesome.
I had also read that you've got a bit of a side hobby in stand-up comedy. Is that true?
Yeah. So this is all kind of related, although it sounds very different. In 2011, when I was going through this really flow phase because the climbs were not going anywhere and there were a lot of questions being asked, for about 4 months, I just locked myself up in the apartment and feeling very depressed. But I would have these crazy thoughts in my head, and I started writing them down, and then I realized, well, I have my first script. So then, I'm not climbing a mountain now, so I was like, okay, let me go up a stage. In Nepal, there is no stand-up culture at all. So if you want to be on stage, you have to kind of produce your own show. So produced the show, went up on stage 2011 September, and from then, I've been doing it regularly, and I just realized that I have this part of my brain. Like, for example, you know, when you're in a really bad situation, it doesn't always have to be a bad situation, but especially when I'm going through something tough or bad situation where I should be crying, there'll be a part of my brain, like, rolling out really funny observations. So I think it's something I have to do. If I don't, then the voice in my head will just make me insane.
Yeah, a defense mechanism.
Yeah, sort of, yeah. Yeah, so it's all kind of related in that sense. So when I was climbing, when I am still doing something, you know, outrageously crazy, there is a part of my brain that has this observation thing going on, so I just bring it up on stage. Mm.
Do you think that summiting Everest gave you the courage to go into stand-up, or not related whatsoever?
I don't think necessarily related in the courage department, because the growing up part where I was not playing sports and anything, I don't have physical confidence, but I was always a big mouth, talkative. So speaking wasn't really a problem. Maybe somewhere that the entire, you know, when you do something physical, I think when for somebody who's never done anything outdoorsy or physical and you do something, it changes something in your, like, wiring. It's a permanent change. There's something in the DNA kind of evolves, and the courage and confidence is completely different. So yes, definitely there has to be a role that whole confidence played. I didn't have a problem getting up on stage or whatever and talking to thousands and thousands of people, but the idea of trying to make people laugh, and at this point of time, I have a social reputation as a climber. So that's a very serious kind of reputation. Mm-hmm. So to go up and make a kind of risk making a fool of out of yourself, that was really, really nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
So I guess long answer to your question, Everest did help in some way.
Uh-huh. Are you still actively doing stand-up as well?
Yeah. So last summer I was in New York and I got sort of a big break. Gotham Comedy Club, which is like one of the biggest club in the country, they put a show for me called Top Shot Comedy with Soily Busnett. So that did really, really well. So I just did another show in early February, February 10th. I had a show at Gotham again, Top Shot Comedy with Soily Busnett. And I might do another again in sometime in the summer.
Mm. Okay, and I think my last question for you, unless Juliana's got another one. I'm not sure if you're familiar with thru-hiking at all, but so the United States, I mean, it's all over the world, but I think it's probably most popular in the United States is there's a lot of long trails. The two most prominent are the Appalachian Trail, which goes from mm-hmm. Georgia to Maine, and the Pacific Crest Trail, which goes from Mexico to Canada through California, Oregon, and Washington. Would you have any interest in getting into thru-hiking or backpacking as opposed to mountaineering?
Sure, I love all kinds of I think I want to pick some sport at this point right now. I've not decided when, but yes, I want to. I would be totally open to that kind of idea.
I think there's a lot of crossover between mountaineering and backpacking. Maybe not so much skill set wise. I mean, there obviously is overlap, but just like I'm speaking.
I mean, a lot of the thought process seems to be similar,
right?
In
exactly.
That, you know,
but even physically, I think there is a lot of similarity, and you have to be good in. There's a certain level of like you have to be good, both in the mountains and in the outdoors, in the backpacking, in kind of similar ways, survival basically.
Right.
That brings out kind of similar skills, and for me, I think where it is relevant is that. Now, you've been to these mountains. You know not everybody on the planet is going to do that. But I think, for example, think of the Himalayas, right? Think of Everest and the other really, really big mountains. I feel like their power, their force is such that imagine you've never seen a sea or ocean, which is the case for me because growing up, because we're a landlocked country, and you've read it in the book and you've seen it in the movies, you've seen pictures, but you've never been on the ocean. And then imagine being in the ocean for the first time. I think Himalayas are a similar force of nature. You could read so much about it. You could see it in the movies, IMAX theaters, whatever. But if you're somebody who's interested in seeing different forms of the planet, then you have to see the Himalayas with your own eyes at least once in life. And now, because I've seen the Himalayas so close, I want to get more people to at least, even if they don't climb the mountain, I want them to see the mountain at least. So that's why I do some guiding. We've been training females to become trekking guides, and people from all over the world can come and they can backpack, they can do whatever, and just enjoy these high Himalayan trails and see mountains up close. So I don't think that there is a strict specialization necessary. It's about enjoying the Himalayas, whatever ways you can do, and backpacking is definitely one of the ways to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And awesome. I've got one final question, which is that in regards to you saying that when you were preparing to summit Everest and, just preparing to do the training and things like that, you faced a lot of backlash and discouragement from people being a woman team and doing all things like that. If you were to have to give any types of words of encouragement to other women that want to get outside and want to be doing these things and are facing that type of discouraging environment, what would you, what would your advice be to them?
So in retrospect, one is that there were definitely people, supporters who believed in us, who wanted to bet in us. There were people, I remember one of them looking into my eyes and saying, "You have no idea what you're doing. Like, you're going to, the impact it's going to make for women all over the world." And that person, he's right. It was a man and he was right. 2007, I had no idea what this could mean, that I would one day be invited to a podcast in United States to share my experience. So there will be people who also want to believe in you. And so give them a chance to believe in you. Like, you have to be that good. You have to be that committed. That is like one of the things about Everest is that it does not care if you're a man or a woman. It does not care whoever, whatever you are. You pick a goal, you better be as good as it demands. And no excuse. If you say, well, you know, I'm a woman, or I'm from a developing country, or I'm this skin color, or this, or none of my folks have ever done it, you're holding on to an excuse. So don't hold on to an excuse. You pick a goal, you better be good for that. And once you prove yourself to yourself first, then, you know, it's all gonna unroll. I think eventually it's gonna come together. I couldn't think of all of these things when I was going about it, but looking back, I don't feel bad that anybody did not believe in me, because or my team, because now I can understand that people say something is impossible because they've not seen it happen. So if people say, hey, you cannot do it, I would be very happy, because they're like, oh, they've never seen anybody like me do this before, so here's my chance. So I'd be thrilled about it if somebody said this, I couldn't do something today.
Right. That's a great way to look at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's next for you? Do you know, you said that you're doing some guiding and you're working with people on a more personal basis, but do you have any major adventures locked in yet?
Right now it's about trying to balance everything as Everest and the climbing journey has produced. So there is this nonprofit work. We're supporting schools in a really remote village, which is very important. We want to continue doing that. We're training survivors of trafficking to become trekking guides. It's really important. I feel like that was the reason Everest even accepted me in the first place, so that we could come around with this. So that's really important, and we're going to continue doing that. I also have a speaking career, so I make my living doing motivational speaking at corporate schools, institutes. So that's something I've slowly started entering into the world market, so that's something I would definitely want to keep doing. New doors are opening for me in the United States with my comedy, so it makes you wonder what you could do. So having a big club kind of trust you and put you kind of regularly is a big deal, so I definitely don't want to give up on that. It's part of me, it's who I am, so I want to continue doing that. So it's going to be about balancing all of these things. I'm still, like I said, tight with my teammates, so we're kind of itching for the next climb. We don't have anything to announce yet, but there'll be some adventure coming soon.
Yeah. Well, you've got a very powerful, inspirational message, and thank you for sharing it with us. So you mentioned the Seven Summits website. If people wanted to connect with you or find out more about you, would you recommend they go there, or is there another place that they should check you out?
Yes, so definitely it's easier to remember sevensummitswomen.org, Seven Summits Women page on Facebook. Personally, my website is just my name, shailibusnet.com. So
we can link to that.
Yes, so people can just go to my website if they are also interested in my speaking, or if they want to see me perform comedy and other stuff. So you can also visit my personal website or my team's website. Either way, it works.
Awesome.
Perfect.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah,
this was awesome.
So much.
Thanks so much for carving out some time. And I'm glad it worked out. I'm glad you were in Denver while we were. It was Chris Baker from, he's one of the founders of Wayfinder, which is where we're recording right now. He's the one that told me to reach out to you, and I'm thrilled that he made that suggestion. So thank you so much for coming on.
I had a great time. Thank you for taking me back to the summit and back. So this has been great. Thanks so much.
Yes, yeah. Thank you. So that was an awesome interview. Not an eye view. I really enjoyed that. What did you think?
I thought it was so cool.
Yeah.
Like, I read Into Thin Air, and it sounds so scary doing Everest, like, just based off that book, and she made it just sound like a good time. Like, you're dancing on the top of Everest, are you kidding? Like, so nonchalantly, you know?
The part where she's talking about walking past dead bodies to achieve her goal, like, that's mind-blowing to me.
I read somewhere that one of the dead bodies, like, they actually use as, like, a cairn of sorts, like a trail marker, because that's where how they know they've gotten to a certain whatever it is, but...
So take a left at Dead Fred.
Right.
So I'm super stoked about a new series on the trek. It's a mailbag featuring one of the most prominent thru-hikers in the community. Her name is Jennifer Farr Davis. She probably doesn't need any introduction, but if in the off chance you don't know who she is, Jennifer Farr Davis, also known as Odessa? Shit, now I'm not even sure. But she set the Appalachian Trail FKT in 2011. Which was the same year that I hiked. We're not related. Although, no relation. She had the she had the supported record for, I want to say it was 5 years until it was broken by Jurek. And Jurek, you know, he's a world class ultra athlete. I think he's probably one of the biggest names in the sport. And he broke her record by, I think, just a few hours. It was very, very, very close. There was, at the very end, people weren't sure if it was actually going to happen. She won National Geographic's Adventure of the Year in 2012.
So cool.
Yeah, she's written, I think, 5 books. You'll have to check out her website to get the exact count, but she's prolific. She's done a bunch of trails. She's also very family oriented. She's married. She's got a youngster.
Probably wouldn't curse on this podcast.
Yeah. So yeah, when she comes out here next, we're definitely going to get her on the show. She's based in Asheville, but when she makes her next trip back out to the Rockies, definitely going to lock her down and get her on the show.
Or with that Patreon account, we could go to her.
That's what I'm saying. So if you guys want to expedite the JPD interview process, you know,
if you want to force me and Zach to travel together.
Those are two good, compelling reasons to donate to us. Either have us shut up or, on the flip side, have us talk to Jennifer Farr Davis. So whatever is more compelling to you, go with that. But yeah, so she's doing a new mailbag series on the website twice per month. She's taking your questions, and, you know, being a 5-time author, she's very eloquent. She's very well spoken and writes very well. And the first subject that she tackled is a controversial one, which is not something that I intend to go into at all. But if you want to read her take, which you should, she kind of dissects the Lint versus Carrot Quinn fiasco that went down on Instagram and then subsequently on their personal blogs. As I said, I'm not going to touch that with a 100-foot pole, but if you want to read her take, which you should, you can. It's on the website. If you just Google Jennifer Farr Davis mailbag, you'll find it. Otherwise, it'll be in the show notes for this episode. And more importantly, if you want your questions answered by the trail legend, submit them to editors@thetrek.co. The next thing I want to talk about is actually an article that came out today. Depending on when this actually gets published, it'll probably be a couple weeks in the rearview mirror, but it's something that I wrote for the REI blog. It's probably the question that I've gotten more than any other toward the end of my PCT hike was people asking me to compare how the PCT and the AT were. That was a good sentence. To compare the AT and PCT, which is a big subject. I think overall they have more in common than the more similarities than differences, you know, just from like a psychological standpoint. A half year backpacking is a half year backpacking, but you know, from landscape, from gear selection, logistics, etc., there are definitely a lot of differences. And you can read the article if you want to check it out. Again, it'll be in the show notes, but I just wanted to highlight a few of the big ones here. So the first one that I want to address are the gear differences, and not necessarily the nitty gritty details about the differences between the two trails, but just overall the bigger conceptual picture of how you view your gear changes. So on the PCT, and Chance, I'm sure you can speak to this, but your gear really fluctuates from section to section. So I imagine what you used in the desert looked a lot different than what you used through the Sierra. I guess, so you skipped the Sierra, but
well,
you started off.
Well, the funny thing about that
yeah,
is.
Yeah, you got into the Sierra a little bit.
I dabbled.
You dabbled in the Sierra. So, I mean, like, for instance, you know, you're going from potentially triple degree temperatures. Do you recall the hottest temperature that you saw through the desert?
Oh, it was in the hundreds.
Yeah.
We were just going through some days at the end where it was getting really high up there as it got later into the season, and there was I'm gonna go off a tangent, there was just no shade and it was hot, so that was a bit different. But it was also really cold at night in the desert, so I actually carried a lot more stuff for warmth in the desert than I did even in Washington. But I think the key thing for me for the PCT in terms of gear was that I had a box at home full of every piece of gear I either wanted, might want, or sent home. And my housemates were under strict instruction with labels of like what was what, and when I needed something, they would mail it.
Yeah.
So I had it really easy in that way, but I sub stuff out all the time just because I had that support system at home.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was a lot of swapping out of things,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, for instance, like you said, it does get very cold in the desert. But like, for instance, going from the desert to the Sierra, all of a sudden you need a bear canister. Last year you needed snow gear. These are not things you're using in the desert. In the desert, you, like, sun protection is a huge deal. Like myself, you are a ginger. We are the Cinnamon Connection for a reason. What was your sun protection plan?
Oh, you don't want to know.
I do want to know.
Okay. We found a bucket hat in a bush going down the 19-mile downhill into Cabazon.
Classic,
that went on my head.
Classic bush hat.
The girl I was hiking with constantly reminded me that I had to put on sunscreen, so I would use some of hers.
Uh-huh. So you were mooching sunscreen off of your hiking group?
Yeah, because I'll put it on my face, but I don't know. The arms, do you need it? Probably. But,
I mean, I don't, but I'm also built kind of like a Yeti. I'm very hairy. Just from afar, your arms don't look quite as bushy as mine.
My arm hair grows in blonde.
Uh-huh, nice.
Thank you.
Good strategy.
Yeah, but I had a long sleeve shirt that I kept with me up until I got the Hawaiian shirt, and that was basically arm protection. I would wear long pants until about 1 p.m., and that was leg protection?
Leg protection sounds right.
But yeah, no, mainly I just found a bucket hat in a bush and would put on sunscreen whenever Mom would tell me I had to.
Yeah. No umbrella?
No.
Yeah.
Mary Poppins, are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding you, because I needed an umbrella. I melt under the sun.
To be fair, I wish I had one, because there was a part where there was no shade at all, and it was the middle of the day, and we, like, needed to take a break, because we just couldn't walk. It was so hot. We were in a dry stretch. And I still had the hammock on me at the time. Thank you. We attached that to trekking poles and spread it out and made it, like, a canopy.
Smart.
Because going in the tent was too hot.
Yeah.
But we had this, it was good until the wind blew, and then it stopped working completely.
So I was on the fence about using the sun umbrella just because I do find it cumbersome. Like, I haven't found the system where I can rig it to my backpack so I can do it hands-free, especially in the desert. It's so windy.
That's just it. If it was hands-free, it would be a different story.
Yeah. It's like, I've done it. I've set it up before that I can use it without my hands. But, like, you know, the angle of the sun's changing. Like, to get it perfect is not easy. And it can just sit on your being awkwardly. So ultimately holding it just ends up being the easiest thing for me.
The girl I hiked with even went so far as to, she had gloves, like specific sun gloves.
I had those as well. Yeah. And they're cut off from the top of the fingers.
I don't remember.
Well, I'll link to those in the show notes as well. And they were actually great because they actually provide a little bit of warmth at night too. So when I got cold, it was just like that little bit of layer that I could use. I mean, it's not the most insulating thing, but it's better than nothing. But yeah. Okay, so yeah, there's definitely gear differences. Back to the bigger point. On the PCT, your gear changes more so based on this section. So like on the PCT is obviously Southern California, i.e. the desert, the Sierra, Northern California, Oregon, and Washington. And your gear will fluctuate from section to section. On the AT, it's much more seasonally based. So for the first part of the trail, I think a lot of people assume that Southern Appalachians in the spring is going to be a pleasant experience. I haven't met anyone that has started in like the normal northbound bubble, like March, April, that hasn't encountered at least one snow. And it's usually multiple snows, and it can be pretty intense. That's just unavoidable. So you're probably going to need, you know, multiple layers. You're going to need sleep insulation down to 20 degrees. But once you get past about Grayson Highlands, sometimes I recommend people can hold on to that all the way to up to like Daleville, which is central Virginia. You're really in the mid-Atlantic part of the AT during the heat of the summer, where it's hot. And not only is it hot, but unlike the PCT, it's also very humid. So the differences between the afternoon high and the overnight low is much smaller than it is on the PCT. As you were saying, in the desert, you can go from 100 degrees down to below freezing. Like, that's probably a fairly common occurrence. On the AT, I can recall so many nights where, like, I have my sleeping bag completely off of me, just sprawled out, and I'm still sweating. That's a pretty typical summer night on the AT. So people usually get their cold weather gear back once they get to the whites. And yeah, they'll finish off the trail with then the same gear that they started off with at that point.
Do people bring tents on the AT? That's such a noob question. There's all those shelters.
But I guarantee you're not the only person. You're asking a question that other people are wondering.
I'm sure you do because like shelters fill up and stuff, but like, would you not just like cowboy camp?
No, because the weather can be atrocious on the AT.
Oh, right, because it rains.
Yeah, it rains a lot. Right. Yeah, so that's a thing. There are people that do it, but it's a horrible idea because what happens is they don't cowboy camp in bad weather. They make people move over and clear space for them. Fair. And a lot of the shelters are overcrowded as is. So by doing that, you are just the asshole that shows up to the shelter at 9 p.m. and is making an overcrowded shelter clear space for you because you packed irresponsibly.
If people hike with a dog, do they bring their dogs in the shelter? Or is there like an unspoken no dog in the shelter rule?
So it's kind of a strange etiquette thing. I think that's a gray area. I think typically people will ask the rest of the people in the shelter if it's cool if they have their dog. More often than not, I think people, if they have a dog, they're more likely to tent just because they don't want to create that sort of issue.
Because I feel like if you ask someone that, no one's going to be like, actually, I do mind.
Well, if people are allergic, you know, dogs...
Oh, I'm allergic?
Yeah. So, I mean, like, if you're allergic, that's a valid reason to be like, you know what? No, go camp. Yeah. So there are definitely gear differences, and I think the biggest differences between the AT and the PCT, like I said, is season versus segment. Another big difference is the definition of a through hike, which varies, it seems, a lot between the trails. On the AT, it seems that through hiking purism is a much more commonly held belief as opposed to it is on the PCT, because on the PCT, as you know, wildfires are a huge deal. Like last year when we hiked, it was, 50 miles through the Jefferson Wilderness had been shut down, and there were no road alternates that were feasible. I mean, you could have walked road, but the PCTA explicitly said, do not do this. It's not safe.
When I had seen you in Timberland Lodge, that was when you and Viking were literally, like, on your phones, like, we need to walk around this fire closure. And it was, like, the most ridiculous type of road walk. Like, the one that the PCT said don't do. And I was just sitting there, and I was like, are you kidding? Like, you're gonna spend, like, however many days it's going to take to walk these highways?
Yeah.
What are you going
to
see?
I know. And to be perfectly honest with you, the fact that we broke a continuous footpath broke my heart.
Yeah, you guys were torn up about it.
We spent a lot of time trying to devise every possible scenario where we could make that happen. Yeah, it's just, you know, I set out really wanting to do a continuous footpath because I came from the AT, and that was kind of the mentality that I'd come over with, was that I wanted to connect my footsteps. Although I didn't do that on the AT, full disclosure, I did Aquablaze through the Shenandoah section. I did like 50 miles on a canoe,
what?
Rather. Yeah, so this is a thing through the southern part of the Shenandoah section, which is a national park.
Where did you find a kayak?
Long story, but we got some trail magic in Waynesboro. The guy that lived there, he's an avid water sportsman, and he organized the entire thing. And you know, I went out to the AT in searching an adventure. Like I didn't even know the purism debate. I didn't know that was like a real thing.
And I didn't know that when I got to the PCT at all.
Yeah, and it's silly. Like, once you go into the Facebook groups and the forums and whatnot...
Well, it's funny that, like, you point out, like, how it, like, stems from the AT, because we didn't really, like, know that that was a thing. You know, in our minds, we were going from Mexico to Canada, we weren't skipping anything, and we were going to get there. And, you know, as we got closer to the Sierra, we met up with a group of AT thru-hikers, Scuba Steve was one of them, but he wasn't really part of the group that I'm talking about. But we met up with a group of people that we hiked with for a bit. They were really cool. They had hiked the AT, I think, in 2015. But even the first day I met them, I was too scared to talk at lunch because, like, you just heard them talking. Like, they were so opinionated in exactly how things were supposed to be done that it was like, I'm not opening my mouth. And as we got closer to the Sierras, like, they were so stern about, like, you know, the people that we knew that had flipped up, like, their pussies, you know, like, went, like, you know, this, and that. And you just, like, okay, like, that's a mindset that people have. But the funny thing I noticed about that was that when the Sierra came, one by one, they got off trail. One of them flipped north and finished the rest of the trail. They all got there and said, I'm getting off trail, I'll do it again next year. Which, I mean, in my mind, like, this is going to be a debate, but in my mind, if you're going to say, I've gotten to this hard spot on trail, I'm going to go home and try again in an easier year so that I can say that it was a true through, how is that more hardcore than someone who says, I've gotten to this hard point, I need to find a way to work around it, and that finds a way to work through all the hard shit? Like, I'm not saying that, like,
yeah,
you know, it's not a truther if they do it. I'm not saying that anyone who doesn't do everything is. I'm just saying, that was something that blew my mind, was that they had these firm opinions, but then were so easy to say, I'm going to go home and do it in an easier year, and then I'll still have this hardcore status.
Yeah. I personally think it's more admirable to make the best of an imperfect situation than it is to wait for your environment to change. And I think a lot of that stems from people, you know, how they're going to be perceived as opposed to their own true intrinsic opinion of what a thru hike is to them. Like, they want the bragging rights of saying that they connected every footstep more so than they actually want to do the best that they can given the situation that they have.
Right. I guess in my mind, like, when I got to that stuff and I had to flip, it was, you know, like, I had planned and worked, you know, up to this point to go straight through, and that isn't looking like it's going to happen. How am I going to rework things and get through things so that I can complete as many miles as I can
right
by the time I get to Canada?
So this goes back to the bigger point, is I think the purism thing is not as big of a deal in the PCT, and I think it's changing because of what you said. There's more AT hikers carrying over that mentality.
Yeah.
But like, I hiked with Jabba, and he did the PCT 3 consecutive years, and each of those years there were major trail closures because of fire. Just because this year is a low snow year doesn't mean that there's not going to be major trail closures. Like, odds are that there's going to be a lot of fires. In my personal opinion, is you make the best of an imperfect situation. And if there was a road walk that was feasible that the PCTA didn't explicitly say it was dangerous, I would have gladly taken it.
Yeah,
but that's
definitely
not the way that it worked out.
Right.
And, you know, as soon as we started to hitch around the section that was closed, you know, I was very upset, but that was when it really clicked that we had made the right decision, because this was I think the speed limit was like 50 miles per hour.
Mm-hmm.
There's no shoulder. It's a very windy road. Like, that would have been the most dangerous part of the hike without any redeeming aspects whatsoever. So to put myself in that situation just to be true to the through, like you're saying, is asinine. It's not a game that I want to participate in. More power to you if you do want to connect your steps. I totally understand. That was the goal that I set out for. But I learned that the PCT is a different beast.
Yeah.
So back to the bigger picture, is like, I think that the culture is different for that exact reason. The other thing is, people want to know which trail is more difficult. And I think if you read enough online, not the consensus, but probably the majority of people are going to say that the PCT is the easier trail, which, you know, you saw the PCT in a historically difficult year, so you're probably reluctant to accept that as a fact.
No, because the PCT is graded for horses as well, so it's got all the switchbacks, whereas the AT isn't, so it bypasses the switchbacks by just going straight up, right? Is that true?
That is true. So, the AT is a much more rugged trail, much more steep in spots, for sure. But the reason I'm reluctant to call the AT the more difficult trail is because I think that's always relative to what your inherent struggles might be. So, like, on the PCT, for instance, being a ginger and walking through the desert where there's constant sun exposure, like, that's a challenge. Even with the right gear, like, that can be draining on you, especially if you don't tolerate heat and sun exposure all that well. There are people that don't tolerate altitude all that well. There are people that prefer the much denser social network that exists on the AT, and obviously the PCT is catching up, but like, for instance, last year where people were flipping all over the place, there's a very good chance that you can get separated from your group and be by yourself for a couple of days. Like, it's unlikely that scenario is going to play out on the AT unless you're hiking southbound, you're doing a flip-flop, or you're starting really early or really late. If you're starting in the bubble, you're probably going to be around people the entire time, and if you want that social safety net, that might legit be the easier trail, even though from a physical standpoint, it'll be more challenging. So I think overall, more people are going to say the PCT is the easier trail. However, you know, that there's variation in that. Personally, I agree with that, But I also got West Nile virus on the AT, so
you know. But that's just a case of the weeks, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I'm very inherently weak.
Yes.
Cool. So to wrap up episode 5, what I think something we should do, because people have been very generous, they've been leaving a lot of reviews, especially, you know, we're only 5 episodes into this.
And yeah, thanks, Mom.
Yeah, thanks to all the our moms out there, Michelle and Sarah.
Sarah, yeah.
Emery like an elephant. I want to just highlight, you know, a few of the 5-star reviews that we've gotten on iTunes.
Oh, we have 5-star. Oh, yeah, we do.
Yeah. The first one I want to highlight is from a guy named Bear who hiked the AT last year, 2017. And he writes, "It's the best backpacking podcast I've found so far." And I'm just going to assume that he's found all of them because...
Oh, yeah. That sounds like a guy who's found all of
that's,
them.
That reeks of just thorough research.
Right. So in comparison to all of them...
Best backpacking podcast I've found out of all of them.
We're paraphrasing now, but we're paraphrasing. I think that's what he's meant.
I love the stories. Easy to relate to with great advice. Bring in more AT content, which I... It happened kind of unintended, but I hope we executed on that decently. But we've got more AT stuff in the pipeline for sure. And he ends the review saying, maybe hikers that have accomplished the Triple Crown. Thank you.
Working on that.
We've got one in the pipeline.
The Viking's done it.
Viking, true. Viking's Triple Crowner.
He's been on 50% of our podcast so far.
Yeah, he's kind of, and if like we're measuring it word per podcast, he might be the most represented person on the show.
The most words spoken thus far.
Yeah, he's leading the league in words. So that was Bear. Thanks, Bear, for the review.
Oh, me next?
Yep.
Madeline Sim says, "Fun topics, interesting guests, and engaging hosts." Oh, thanks.
That's us.
That's us. I'm looking forward to more.
And more you shall get, Madeline.
I haven't seen these ones yet, and I thought I've read all of them.
No, so if you go to, you have to find it on the iTunes app as opposed to like the actual website. I don't know why that is, but. And the last one here is from ADKGirl4. "I listen because of the force of nature known as the real hiking Viking, but Badger's just as smart and funny." Chance, that was really nice of you to highlight this review for me to write here. I'm really glad that you did that. That was generous. She continues, "I loved episode 2. Someone get Scuba Steve his own podcast. He's the Lebowski of thru hiking. It's just walking."
See, that was what I said. Podcast episode 2 was great. I loved the Scuba Steve episode.
I liked episode 2 just because it gave me an excuse to talk about poop. And I
don't remember that.
The next episode is 6, which is technically divisible by 2. So really, it's triple the 2. If we're being mathematical about it, and I am.
No, I don't think so. You know, I'm going to call it sick right now.
Let me check my calculator.
Sorry, I'm sick. I can't come.
Nope. Yep. 3 times 2 is 6. So nope, can't 3 come. Triple the poo for yeah, next episode. Triple the poo, triple the fun. So that's just a small sampling of the reviews that we've got. We thrive off of your guys' iTunes reviews. So if you're listening and you enjoy the show, we would be very appreciative of your review. It doesn't have to be 5-star, but if it's not, it won't get read. Anyways.
Yeah, leave us 5 stars and we'll read it.
Yeah.
Is that a thing we're going to commit to? That's a big commitment.
We don't have to read all of them, but we can read the ones that definitely compliment me a lot.
Okay. Yeah. Keep complimenting Zach.
Yeah.
And he'll read them and I'll sit here pouting.
Cool. I'm all in on that. Chance, where can people find you on the social medias?
I am Juliana_Chauncey on Instagram. Or on YouTube, just search Juliana Chauncey.
If you want to follow me, I'm ZR Davis on Instagram and Twitter. ZR Davis, I think I've kind of mumbled that. You can find all the Trek social on thetrek.co. We are Backpacker Radio on Instagram. If there's one place you should go, it's our Backpacker Radio on Instagram. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Oh, yeah, thanks.